Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back to another edition of the Red Reporter podcast. We are coming to you on a wonderful, wonderful Wednesday evening. The Reds are fresh off a three-game sweep of the Houston Astros. The Cincinnati Reds are fresh off a three-game sweep of the Houston Astros. Not just any Astros, but they beat Justin Verlander, they faced Gerrit Cole, and somehow managed to find a way to beat the Astros in both of those games. So it's a good time to be in Reds land, perhaps the best time all season, to be honest. They're 34-38, but they're riding a four-game win streak. And after the first couple games against the Texas Rangers over the weekend, didn't go quite as planned. They did pick up a big win on Sunday and parlayed that into sweeping the Astros for their first series sweep of the season. Well, the Astros' first losing series sweep of the season, I should say. So with that in mind, we've got Tony Wolf with me today. Tony, what's going on, buddy? What are you thinking about these Reds?
Oh, I'm doing very well, especially after seeing the Reds sweep the Astros this afternoon. It's been a very long time since it felt like there was so much emotion behind a Reds win as there was today. Obviously, three straight one-run wins over maybe the best team in baseball is already pretty great. But the fact that the Reds have only had one other four-game win streak this season, and that came when they beat the Miami Marlins three times and then the Cardinals once. This beating the Rangers once and the Astros three times has a little bit different feel. So the Reds undoubtedly feel good right now, and so do I. So that's it's all good right now.
Yeah, 100%. Not just that, but they came home. It was a six-game homestand and got off the 0-2 start. And it's like, what the hell? Like, you guys, over the last few years, what the Reds have been is many, many things, which is largely bad. But they've always at least been a half-decent team at home. And when you've got a six-game spurt against those two teams, you got to make hay at home. And to start out 0-2, that was probably the lowest point of the season for me, I think. I mean, with the 1-8 start was obviously miserable, but you know there's still infinite time to recover from that. Starting out a homestand 0-2 to drop, what, eight games under .500 at this juncture of the season, the way this roster is constructed and everything else with so many pending free agents – and the writing on the wall of the Astros coming to town, they could have been, what, 11 games under .500 right now if they hadn't come out and taken all three of those games. The fact that they responded as well as they did, I think, was a pretty hopefully down the road we can look back and say that was a pretty pivotal moment for this particular Reds of roster, because if things went wrong for 3 days in a row right here, they're suddenly up against it in a way that seems kind of unfathomable now that they won three in a row.
Yeah, I mean, and especially just the just what the Astros are, it really didn't even seem like something that was up in the air. You know, it wasn't something of, maybe the Reds can take two out of three here and keep, you know, try to build a little bit of momentum. The Astros are monsters, and even without Carlos Correa, George Springer, you know, some of the guys that they were missing for this series, the Astros still just are pose such a formidable force. They're, you know, arguably the best team in, like I said, you know, arguably the best team in baseball. The Dodgers and Yankees being up there somewhere as well. And they had, you know, it's not like the Reds got a break as far as the pitchers they were facing. Like you said, you know, Garrett Cole, Justin Verlander, Wade Miley has been very good for them. It felt somewhat inevitable that the Reds were going to lose at least two, maybe all three games of this series, especially after they lost two out of three to the Rangers. And so the fact that they were able to pull this off, this is the first series the Reds have won since May 24th to May 26th, which was almost like 4 weeks ago. Fittingly, that series they won was against the Chicago Cubs, who are another very good team who has a very dangerous build going towards the postseason. So it's very odd what the Reds just did over the last 3 days, but something that they absolutely – it was absolutely necessary for them to even keep a little bit of suspense alive in their season because, yeah, if they come out of this series – 31-41. They're done. That's it. That's the whole year is pretty much gone. And you're looking down the barrel of four games against the Brewers, two against the Angels, three against the Cubs, four more against the Brewers. 10 games under 500 in the middle of June. So it wouldn't have been a great feel for this team. So very, very important sweep today.
Yeah, 100%. I think that I'm just kind of thinking about it and talking out loud while doing so. The nature of how they won today specifically, but also throughout the course of the series, is also something I think it's pretty important because, you know, you mentioned Wade Miley and Justin Verlander and Garrett Cole, just powerhouse pitchers who have been good for years. And Miley at least has been very, very good since the beginning of last year. Had to put there to Derek Johnson a little bit on that one also. But you look at those starting pitching matchups, and it was Luis Castillo, it was Sonny Gray, it was Tyler Malley. That's the core of the Reds' rotation for the future too. You know, as good as Tanner Roark has been this year, he's 32 and a pending free agent. Even Anthony DeSclafani is a free agent after next year. You look up at those three starters, and all of whom have shown flashes of absolute brilliance at times. Malley start last year, at times this year, including today, and then obviously Luis Castillo and Sonny Gray speak for themselves with their overall records. But given how much team control the Reds have over those three guys, that's the rotation that they have built during this rebuild. That's the core of that rotation. And to see the three of those guys go head to head with the caliber pitchers and the caliber lineup they were up against, even with those injuries that you mentioned as well, I think that was pretty telling too, because it wasn't like the Reds were leaning on guys that are set to be free agents in this series to get those wins. And then today, even, you look up and the comeback win in the ninth, who was it? It was Jose Peraza. It was Nick Senzel. It was Jesse Winker, which in theory, those are three key cogs for the Reds for the next 4, 5, 6 years. And to see them come through in that way against a team of this caliber, I think was super special because I feel like it's kind of a growing moment almost. And, that's not something that you can statistically categorize, I don't think. But I do think it is one of those things that players will always kind of file away. And I would be shocked 10 years from now you talk about this particular series and this particular game to some of those guys involved, and they wouldn't remember it because I feel like it was that kind of pivotal to a franchise in the Reds that has been beaten up by good teams for a long time now.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I have to make one correction. It was Anthony DeSclafani that went up against Justin Verlander, not Sonny Gray.
It was Sonny against the Rangers on the weekend, right?
Sonny Gray was the one who started in the very first game of the what is now a 4-game win streak. But I mean, even with that, you know, Anthony DeSclafani and Tyler Malley, who pitched today on Wednesday, those two have been the most unpredictable, I guess I'll say, starters in the Reds rotation right now. You know, so Luis Castillo has been dominant for the most part. You know, he's had some walk troubles, but he's been very, very good. He's having the best season of his career. It's already worth something like 3.5 wins on Baseball Reference. Then Sonny Gray has had a great year. Tanner Roark has had a great year. Anthony DeSclafani and Tyler Malley, they're not the two Red starters that you would choose to go up against Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole. But Anthony DeSclafani went out and threw 5 1/3 one-run innings. It's his third start in June, and he's given up one run in all of them. Tyler Mahle has had a bumpy road of late. He came out today and was lights out. You know, he made one questionable pitch to Michael Brantley that ended up getting turned into the only two runs that the Astros scored during the afternoon. But other than that, he was great. You know, the Reds only gave up 7 runs to the Astros in this entire 3-game series. And that just, you know, we've talked so much about how improved the Reds pitching staff is and how impressed we've been with that turnaround. But for them to hold the Astros, who are, you know, along with the Dodgers and the Yankees, pretty much the pinnacle of offensive excellence right now in baseball, for them to hold the Astros to 7 runs in 3 games without using, you know, maybe their best 3 starters, and even resorting to some unconventional bullpen usage with Michael Lorenzen saving 2 games instead of Raisel Iglesias being that hammer at the end of the game. That just says so much about where this pitching staff is, and just the level that they are able to compete at this stage of the year. And that's even with the offense going through the fits and starts it's gone through this year, that's really exciting.
Yeah, and that's another topic that I totally wanted to brush on as well. David Bell turning to Raisel Iglesias as his 8th inning guy, and I say 8th inning guy as if that's what his role is. It's a leverage role, and that's what he, in theory, was supposed to be signed to do when they renegotiated his contract and guaranteed him the 3 years and, what, $24 million to eliminate the arbitration process this past winter, because the arbitration process historically rewards stats like saves, and the writing on the wall from the Reds doing that was saying, hey, you're our best pitcher. We want to sign you to this deal, but you might not just be getting 3 outs in the 9th inning if that's not when you're needed most. What are your thoughts on him, David Bell, turning to Michael Lorenzen after Raisel Iglesias pitched the last 2 outs of the 8th and the first of the 9th 2 games ago and got Alex Bregman to pop out and then got pulled. And then yesterday also giving Michael Lorenzen the chance to get the save in the 9th inning too. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's something that's controversial, or do you think it's something that they basically spelled out in the front of the season and are just now getting around to doing?
Yeah, it's weird. You know, Raisel Iglesias, with his background, he was already he was a starter when he first came up. So with him transitioning to the bullpen when he did, I think we always kind of hoped that he would be a little bit more of a swingman is the wrong word, maybe, but not necessarily the closer, not necessarily the ninth inning guy, but what we've seen out of like Andrew Miller and Josh Hader and Brad Hand, some of those guys, where he's not someone you necessarily bring in to just close the game, but he's somebody that you bring in when you've got a tough situation, you know, 2 guys on, 2 outs, that sort of thing, where you've got to have, there's just no excuse not to have your best arm throwing in that moment. And someone who can go get you, you know, if your starter's done in the 6th, but it's a really important game and it's 1 or 2 runs difference, you've got Iglesias for 5 outs or 6 outs, something like that. And so that part of it is encouraging. We've seen him used like that a little bit in the past, but not a whole lot. This series was very interesting, and from the standpoint that they really seemed to use him, you know, and almost, you know, almost intentionally, as in a way that's like, you're not going to close this game. We need you for these outs right now. We have guys for the next, the next 3 outs. In Tuesday's game, he was brought in to pitch for Amir Garrett with I believe, one guy on.
Yeah, Michael Brantley was on first, and he got Yuli Gurriel and Robinson Chirinos, who are two of the most hot bats in the Houston lineup. Right. And then the day before, he got Alex Bregman as his final out. So he's facing the guys that you would want him to face. And then I'm just looking at the gameplay last night, and not that Michael Lorenzen wasn't electric in the ninth inning, but he was getting Tyler White, Tony Kemp, and Josh Reddick. So he was getting two guys who were largely backups playing because of Springer and Altuve's injuries. To get that save in the ninth inning. So not to diminish what Lorenzen did or how well he looked in that particular role. But, you know, as you mentioned also, like, it's a leverage thing. You're getting the best bats in the opposing lineup out the last time that you want them to come up to the plate. And that's certainly what it seemed like he was tasked with doing, and he did it.
Right. And even in Tuesday's game, the pitcher spot was due up third in the next inning. You know, they didn't. It never really seemed like and something where the intention was, oh, Iglesias is going to get the next five outs. You know, they brought him in to get the two outs where they really needed them the most in the eighth inning, and then they brought in Josh Van Meter to pinch hit for him, and Lorenzen was able to come in the ninth inning. And I think Monday, Iglesias was just – he just wasn't that sharp. He got the outs he needed to, but he was – He was a little bit wild. You know, he wasn't throwing as many strikes as you would have liked to see him throw. So they took him out. They brought in Lorenzen, and he finished the game. So I don't necessarily know that I want to see Michael Lorenzen as the ninth inning guy going forward. Even though Michael Lorenzen's had a very good year. He's got a 3.05 ERA. He's striking out a lot more guys. He's walking fewer guys. He's had a very good year as a reliever, but just the entire idea of Raisel Iglesias maybe being a multi-inning slash just floating reliever where he's used where you need him, he's used where you know that these outs are the most important outs you're going to get in the game. When it comes down to it, when Raisel Iglesias has his best stuff, when he's throwing the way we've all seen him throw in the very recent past, he's maybe the best pitcher on the team, if not, you know, behind Luis Castillo and like Sonny Gray. You know, those are the guys that even have a shot of being better.
Yes, like stuff wise. Yeah, there's maybe Castillo is the only one who's got better stuff, And let's be honest, like if you look over the past 3, 4, 5 years of Major League Baseball, Andrew Miller hasn't been a closer, but he's, you know, getting paid $12 to $15 million a year because he's that good. David Robertson's been the same way. Dellin Betances has been the same way. Who else? Wade Davis, before he landed the huge contract to be the Rockies closer, was that guy. He was the high leverage former starter who could get you 40 pitches and 7 outs if you needed him to middle of the game. I think that's kind of what, I mean, ideally that's what you want Iglesias to be. And on paper, that's kind of what David Bell and Dick Williams hinted at that he was going to be when he signed like the concrete extension this winter. We just hadn't seen him used in that role yet this year. I think we finally saw that, and it's interesting. It's certainly interesting, especially with the looming trade deadline coming up, because you saw that initially and you're like, wait, what are they doing? Like, are they changing roles? Are they seeing out if they've got a ready-made replacement closer on the roster? All that stuff kind of went through your head. But when you kind of walk it back and think about it, that's really how the bullpen was supposed to be set up. Heck, even up in Milwaukee with Derek Johnson the last couple of years, Josh Hader hasn't been the closer. He's been that get the best guys out guy, and then they had Corey Knebel before he got hurt to kind of wipe up the ninth inning. So I think that's what that is. And if it is, I'm pretty confident in that move, because I think that's the best thing for the long term health of this bullpen. And it was cool to see. It was a little abrupt, but definitely cool to see, and it certainly worked out. So
well, and this bullpen is finally one where you feel comfortable saying, you know, if Raisel Iglesias gets through this tough spot we have in the seventh or eighth inning, we've got guys we can trust in the eighth or ninth. You know, for the first time in years, the Reds have a really good bullpen. As of right now, I think they're second in the majors in F and Fangraphs WAR by their bullpen. You know, we've talked about Iglesias and Mike Lorenzen, but Amir Garrett's had a fantastic year. Jared Hughes, even though he hasn't been as sharp as he was last year, he's still been pretty solid. David Hernandez has been a pretty underrated part of the bullpen. Robert Stevenson has had great flashes. Matt Bowman just threw two scoreless innings today.
Two huge innings, you know. I mean, that bought the Reds the win right there.
Yeah, so you see, you know, if Iglesias has to come in the eighth inning and scrub up a couple of outs, the Reds are finally in this position where you can see David Bell turning to the bullpen and saying, okay, I've got Amir Garrett, who has been absolutely fantastic this year. I've still got Michael Lorenzen, who's having a career best year out of the bullpen. I've got David Hernandez, who I know can miss bats and do very well for us. So that's another really important aspect of all of this is just how deep the Reds bullpen arms are right now compared to the last several years.
Yeah, 100%. And for a little bit of a segue here, pretty much the only two bullpen arms that haven't performed well at all this year are a pair of lefties. One is now currently on the DL, whether it's the Phantom DL or the real DL, and Wandy Peralta. And the other is Zach Duke, who also hit the real DL or maybe the Phantom DL earlier in the season also. We've got a couple questions. I reached out to our Twitter followers to see what they had to ask about earlier today. And one of the specific questions was, what do the Reds do when Alex Wood gets healthy? This is from our good friend and former Red Reporter writer, Uncle Wheeze. Wheeze, how you doing, buddy? The question for me, I guess, is Alex Wood's in a pretty precarious situation in terms of his future, which is obviously a big, big thing and, you know, financial mandate that he goes through the next couple months and couple weeks in a proper way because he's 28 years old and trying to set himself and his family up for their future. He's been a starter primarily for the last couple seasons and been a very, very good one. But he also has a lot of experience as a reliever. And here we are on June 19th, and he's still just throwing bullpens and live BPs, which he did earlier today or earlier this week, and seems set to go out on a rehab stint soon. Do you think it's worthwhile for the Reds to give him that much more time to stretch out as a starter, which means he might get maybe one, maybe two starts in before the July 31st trade deadline? Or do they work him as a reliever and trying to get him back to the big leagues as quickly as possible, perhaps as that second lefty in the bullpen to Amir Garrett and taking the place of a guy like Zach Duke or Wandy Peralta, who hasn't performed well this year?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's just one of those things where if the Reds, you want to use Alex Wood as a starter. That's what they traded him for, or that's what they traded for him for. They brought him in to be a left-handed starter in their rotation, which they do not currently have. So letting go of that is going to be, I think, a little bit tough. However, you know, he's performed very, like, as you said, he's performed very well as a reliever over the course of his career, and the Reds are in pretty big need of a left-handed reliever. Outside of Amir Garrett, they really haven't had someone that they can count on throwing from the left side coming out of their bullpen. They've brought Cody Reed up and down all year, so I still would like to see. I would still like to see Alex Wood be brought back as a starter and try to stretch him out, try to work him in that way, because of the fact that, you know, that's what you brought him in for, and also you just never know what the health of your rotation is going to look like day to day. Right now they've had very good luck with the arms. I hear the knocking on wood. They've had very good luck with their arms, I better do that as well. With the arms out of their starting rotation. But, you know, as we know, just as Reds fans and as baseball fans, that can change any minute practically. So whenever that does, I think you would like to have a guy like Alex Wood be built up, be ready to join the rotation if need be. But yeah, I think it is nice to see the Reds in a position where you have this veteran who's thrown a lot of important innings for some very successful clubs, who, when he joins you, hopefully in the next month or so, you can basically plug him in wherever you see fit. You know, if he ends up filling the role of Tyler Mahle or Anthony DeSclafani, if they start to trail off again in the next couple weeks, great. If he joins the bullpen as something of a two-inning reliever, then that's also a very positive thing. You know, it's we talked about this a little bit last week. It's a very odd situation that the Reds are going to have when Alex Wood comes back, and there's just so much that seems up in the air right now in terms of which roles guys have and what needs the team is going to have and where they're going to be in as far as the season goes. Because again, you know, if they bottom out again and they lose six of the next eight games, now they're in pretty much the position they were heading into the third game of the Rangers series, except now it's, you know, another week and a half from now, and they've lost important games to division rivals, and they're more geared towards selling. Whereas if they beat the Brewers 3 out of 4 games and the Cubs 2 out of 3 games, now you might be looking at a team that is only 3-4 games out of the division race 10 days from now, and they have to think a little bit more seriously about how best to build this team to succeed this season. So it's a very odd question.
Yeah, and moving kind of, I don't want to say moving on because they're kind of overlapping questions, but from at Ronson92, Ronnie Swingo asks, of the expiring one-year contracts, who should the Reds prioritize re-signing this offseason, and who should they trade / let walk? That kind of jumps into what I was going to mention, which is, and I always come back to this, and it's kind of shocking to me at this point in my life where I look back and realize this is 15 years ago. But on that 2004 Boston Red Sox run to their first World Series championship in a millennia, they traded their best player midseason. They traded Nomar Garciaparra midseason that year and went on to win the World Series championship. And obviously, I'm not trying to compare where the current Reds are to that team and not suggesting the Reds are going to win the World Series this year. But I legitimately think that the idea of trying to win more games than they lose this year, even if it means holding players, paying salary, and finishing 83-79 and not making the playoffs, I think they can do that and still be sellers at this trade deadline. And I think that's a concept that a lot of people think is binary, where you're either selling and you lose, or you're keeping everybody and you win, or you have to trade four people and win. The way this Reds roster is constructed and the way that their injured list is currently populated right now, when Scooter Gennett and Alex Wood come back, they're two guys that obviously deserve spots on the 25-man roster, and arguably, you know, heck, what, 3 months ago, you could have, and you probably would have heard it from a lot of people out there that said Alex Wood should have been the opening day starter and Scooter Gennett was the best hitter on the Reds. Bringing those two guys back and making sure they get regular time, whether it's Alex Wood in the rotation or whether it's Scooter Gennett going into second base and playing every single day or 5 out of 6, you add those guys to that roster, somebody's got to sit then. And if they're going to sit, they're not getting value for the team or whatever. They could trade players and backfill with those guys and in theory be just as good, if not better, if things go absolutely perfectly down the stretch. And so when you talk about players who are one-year rentals, and who they should prioritize keeping and or trading. I really think it depends on how soon both of those guys get back and in what role you want them in. Because if Scooter's taking over second base, that's putting Derek Dietrich, who's been the best hitter on the Reds, as your non-second baseman all of a sudden. And that means what? Either you're benching him or you're benching Jesse Winker or Yasiel Puig to get him in the lineup in the corner outfield spots. So maybe if Scooter comes back and looks like he's Scooter, maybe Yasiel Puig becomes the guy you want to target to trade, and you run a Derek Dietrich, Philip Irvin, a Derek Dietrich, Jose Peraza platoon in left field and let Jesse Winker get most of the at-bats in right field. What are your thoughts on that and how many moving parts there are? Because that same outfield argument I just mentioned, when Alex Wood gets back, if they stretch him out as a starter, you could trade Tanner Roark, backfill with Alex Wood, and maybe be even better for the second half of the season than the Reds have been in the first half.
Yeah, I'm on board with the notion that the Reds could trade some of their most expendable trade pieces and not necessarily be worse off by more than a game going forward. You know, it's very interesting to look at this team versus years past, where if the Reds traded, say, Todd Frazier or Jay Bruce at the All-Star break, you were going to get a worse player, probably a significantly worse player, to fill their spot for the remainder of the season. And that's not the case this year. You know, Yasiel Puig, like we've talked about on this podcast before, he's had a pretty strong last couple of weeks, but he's still really underperformed this year. And you know, even the guys who haven't underperformed, guys like Tanner Roark, who we've also mentioned on this podcast, you know, if you replace Tanner Roark with Alex Wood in the rotation, do you get a meaningful drop off from there? And I'm certainly agree with the notion that this team could sell in July and still make something of a push. It just depends on it all comes back to what they're getting back in value. You know, if
right.
I can't, that there's Yasiel Puig is still worth something. If nothing else, then for the draft pick that he might be worth at the end of the season, once you extend him a qualifying offer, and you know just the mystery of him. You know, even if he has sub 700 OPS in July, he's still worth something because you just don't know when he's going to turn it on and catch fire the rest of the way. And so,
and he's got a pretty good background of being a very good playoff performer as well. So
yes,
even if the back of his baseball card this year doesn't look as good as previous years, he's a notoriously slow starter, and he's also a guy who has always shown up in the playoffs. So I feel like even if he doesn't go on a freakish tear between now and the end of June or July, somebody would still want him. How much they're going to give you for him is the question, but somebody's going to want Yasiel Puig if you try to trade him.
Yes, and as far as which guys you keep, or even try to sign after the year, after the year ends, I think I would be surprised to see the Reds sign any of these guys to another contract after the season ends. You know, maybe they. I don't know that I would be heartbroken to see them sign, say, Tanner Roark to a three-year deal after the season. If he finishes the year with a 3.3 FIP, then yeah, he's probably
yeah.
he's been very good this year. He's eaten a lot of innings throughout his career. If the Reds get him to agree to a 3 or 4 year contract that's within their price range, then great. You know, if they want to bring back Jared Hughes or David Hernandez on another 1 or 2 year deal, then great. But I think I would be a little bit surprised to see the Reds be able to bring any of these guys back as far as just holding on to them with the hope that you are able to sign them long term.
Right. Yeah, I think so much of this, and I kind of overlook it also, but what we see early when Scooter Jeanette returns, I think is going to play a very big role in all of this, because he's the one big guy who's a free agent at the end of the year, who's been a Cincinnati Red for a couple of years and has been a big story in town and is obviously a local kid. How quickly he shows that either he's got it back immediately or doesn't look at all like himself, I think is going to help really dictate and drive a lot of this, because I think the injury pretty much cemented that he's not getting traded at the July 31st trade deadline. Which means what? He's going to end up having 80 games, 85, 90 games to be able to show whether or not he's somebody the Reds want to keep long term. And if he looks the part, then that kind of helps a lot of the dominoes fall. Much like, you know, 3 months ago, we said, hey, if Nick Senzel can't play center field, that really changes the alignment of how everything else shakes out. But he's shown so far, he doesn't just look like he's going to be a decent center fielder this year, but that's somebody you can roll out there for the next 5, 6, 7 years, and he's just going to get better. That solves that question. So I think what you see from Scooter for the rest of this season is really going to help determine that, because despite the fact you haven't really heard publicly any real rumblings that the Reds want to sign him long-term, I think there are a lot of people in the front office and in ownership that want to sign him long-term. And if that's the case, then you look up at what this roster would look like after this year if you keep him and trade or let everybody else walk. You've got 4 rotation spots locked down in Luis Castillo, Sonny Gray, and Disco and Tyler Mahle. You've got Lucas Sims at AAA. You've got Tony Santillan on the cusp of coming up. And then you look at position player-wise, and you've got Winker and Senzel at 2 of the corner outfield spots. You've got Eugenio Suarez at 3rd, Votto at 1st, Barnard Casale at catcher. You tie up Scooter at 2nd base, and suddenly you've got Jose Peraza. Is he the future shortstop? Can he be as good as he was last year? Is that something that he's still got in him despite the fact that he struggled this year? And then you've got right field. And at that point, it's like, okay, well, maybe Jesse Winker plays right field. And in left field, you've got maybe Derek Dietrich for next year because he's got a year of team control left. You got Philip Irvin. You got Taylor Trammell on the cusp also. You start looking at how those dominoes shake out and fall out. I think to me, the one person, and Tanner Roark's a good one, I think, because if you can, like you said, if you can get him for 3 years and $36 million or whatever, that's a contract you sign. For me, it's Jose Iglesias, because I think he's the one guy who's what? He's still 29 years old.
Yeah.
Shortstop's the one spot where it's still kind of up in the air. And, you know, obviously Peraza, if you got the Peraza of 2018 this year and had 4 more years left of him, you wouldn't. But you've not seen that from Jose Peraza this year. And he does still, to me, kind of profile as that guy who you can get 450, 500 plate appearances a year from, but play him everywhere. Play him at 2nd, play him at 3rd if you need to, play him at left and center field sometimes. Maybe Jose Iglesias is the guy that obviously you're not going to expect him to hit as well as he's hit this year, but that glove is a primo defensive shortstop glove. I think if anybody's going to get signed, I think he's the one that I would go to and say, how much do you want to be here? How long is it going to take? And really try to hammer out that deal, because I think he's the kind of player that obviously has fit in very well from the get-go with the Reds and could be a very good asset for the next 2-3 years too.
Yeah, Jose Iglesias is the other one I was kind of thinking of. Man, I feel so bad for Jose Iglesias and Scooter Jeanette, just because they with the state of the free agent market the way that it is, they're guys that I know aren't going to get paid super well in free agency, which, you know, as someone who cheers for the Reds, I want them to get good players, and I want them to find bargains where they can, and, you know, all of that. But also, it's a bit of a bummer just as a baseball fan and as someone who knows these guys are people and they should be paid what they're worth. it's a little bit of a bummer to see, you know, a guy like Jose Iglesias, who's been worth something like close to 9 WAR over the past 5 seasons, get a minor league deal this past year, and he's probably, you know, if Jose Iglesias would test the free agent waters this year, I don't know that he gets anything other than a minor league deal again if he goes out and tries and tests the market a little bit. And I don't even know, you know, Scooter Gennett made a little bit of noise this past offseason about how he, or it might have even been during the season last year, where he was a little bit put off by the fact that the Reds didn't try to extend him, and, you know, voiced his desire to stay in Cincinnati. Those are guys that, you know, Scooter Gennett's been a very valuable offensive player who hasn't been a liability defensively. You know, he's been very good. He's been a very good player for the Reds. He was worth like 4 wins last year, and I don't see Scooter Gennett getting a big payday either. So, you know, I'm conflicted with these two players that, you know, could in theory build the next, you know, few years of the Reds middle infield, as far as wanting to see the Reds hold on to them, because I like them and I think that they're good players, and I believe that they're going to produce well for them, and also kind of wishing that they would price themselves out of the Reds market a little bit, or at least out of the where the Reds market has lain in recent past, where, you know, Scooter Gennett goes out and finds himself some $45-50 million deal with somebody, and Jose Iglesias actually gets to sign some kind of, you know, 3-year $30 million deal with some team, because he's very good. You know, these guys are good at playing baseball, and they're worth more money than they're probably going to get in the next few years. So I'm very interested in the free agency cases that lie ahead of them, and I know that I've sort of just dovetailed into a whole other conversation on labor and the market and baseball free agency as we know it. But I can't help but think of anything else when it comes to guys like this that I know, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago would have gotten just much different free agency than they will this year.
I was going to say, like, the moment you started talking about Iglesias and Scooter together, Brandon Phillips was almost like the perfect blend of them. You know, he had the flair and the excellent glove defensively, wasn't nearly as good offensively as Scooter's been the last couple of years. And the Reds signed him for what, 5 years and $72 million, mm-hmm, right before he hit free agency. Yeah. Like, that's a contract that you just aren't going to see anymore until a massive renegotiation of the CBA. I don't envy the position of those guys one bit, especially with Scooter coming off injury. It's one of those things where I look up and say 100% that part of the reason why Scooter and Jose Iglesias and Derek Dietrich stand out so well in all of our minds and the fans' minds is that all three of them got brought in for nothing. Like, Dietrich got non-tendered by the worst team in baseball. Like, yeah. how much of a slap to the – and he's turning 30 this year. Like, you're turning 30, and the worst franchise in baseball said, you're not good enough for a contract. Like, that's a – wow, you know? And the Detroit Tigers basically did the same thing with Jose Iglesias. They let him go and then signed Jordy Mercer for $5 million to replace him. Like, that really, you know, that players like that are that expendable and that the Reds have found homes for them. I think it certainly makes them stand out more so in the fans' mind. But yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's like, you know, the last couple of seasons, we talked so much about trading high on Scooter and finding the next Scooter Gennett. Well, they did. They found that in Derek Dietrich, and it cost them, what, $2 million, and they've got the control over him for next year. That's a lot more palatable than thinking paying Scooter 4 years and $56 million, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I agree with you on that point, because there's certainly the fan aspect where you want them to keep their best players. But then there's also the rational thought process that says, hey, if you keep all the best players, you either have to have a $2 million payroll or you got to trade some of them. And that's where that all comes in, because if you don't get anything for Scooter and you keep him to the end of the year and let him walk, same with Iglesias and let him walk too, is Jose Peraza at shortstop and Derek Dietrich at second base and whoever the hell you find for the other corner outfield spot next year, is that good enough, you know? Or are you banking on the Reds' ability to find some more bargain basement guys that pan out the way that those three have, as opposed to guys like, I don't know, Daniel Descalso or Ian Kinsler, who were also bargain basement guys and haven't really performed at all this year? Because that's the risk you run by trying to save money in those spots. And it's going to be interesting. I mean, the Reds are certainly in a seller's market with a lot of options to sell, but they haven't played their hands with any of them, because they could trade one guy and that will reveal their strategy, but it doesn't give up their strategy before they have to trade them. Because you trade Tanner Roark, you got Alex Wood to backfill. You trade Yasiel Puig, you insert Scooter, move Dietrich to the outfield. They've got so many moving parts that it's one of those things that it's almost hard to even write about, because you've got to write a manifesto on their thought process to even be able to pull it off, because you know they're going to trade somebody. All these players are too good to not be regulars. It just, you don't know which one. They're going to wait for the best offer, and if they get something that bowls them over, they can adjust accordingly. And I guess you would like them to be 38 and 34 while you consider that, because then you also bring in the idea of trading four guys at the deadline, which is something we'll get to in the next couple weeks on the Red Reporter podcast. But for now, they've got juggling ability, and that's kind of an interesting position to be in, because it certainly is not what they've been in the last couple of years while trying to trade guys.
Yeah. And I would certainly, it will be a much more fun conversation to have in 3 weeks, say, if the Reds are within a few games of the wild, we're discussing the viability of them trading for Matt Boyd, than it will be if we're discussing which prospect they might be able to get for Tanner Roark. That there's definitely a side of that I would rather be on, and I guess it's just up to the baseball team to win the games that are necessary for them to make that conversation happen.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I honestly wouldn't be surprised to see the Reds trade Tanner Roark, to see them trade Yasiel Puig, but then to also go out and make a deal like the Pirates did last year for Chris Archer, which was a trade that wasn't for 2018. It was for 2019, you know, go out and get a guy that some other team has put on the market that's a seller and in a position similar to where the Reds were the last three seasons, and be opportunistic with it, you know, and be better or as good for this year, but then also better positioned for the future too. And I think that's something that they've got the ability to do now without other teams having seen their hand, so to speak, because there are so many moving parts to what the Reds could do right now that I guarantee you, whichever first move they make, no other team in baseball is going to be able to pinpoint that that's the one that they saw coming, because it could be any one of 12 different players. And that's, I guess that's a good position to be in, because you've not revealed yourself beforehand. And that in theory means you've got leverage. And hopefully that's something the Reds can use to not just continue to make a 2019 season a better and more fun one than they've had in previous seasons, but also still continue to build for the years beyond this, because I keep mentioning it, but this record payroll the Reds have for this particular season, if they don't do anything and just let all the free agents walk, they're going to shed $63 to $65 million of payroll, which means they've got the flexibility for 2020 and beyond of any team. They've got a very enviable position, because they've got a great young core, and in theory is up to $80 million they could spend this offseason for 2020 payroll. And that's a cool spot to be in. But that said, it does mean the front office is going to have to be very, very active and very diligent and not miss an opportunity, because that's what this kind of scenario and this kind of roster is presenting themselves with every opportunity. But you got to be ready to capitalize on it when the right spot presents itself. So, well, cool. Well, with that, how about maybe we wrap this one up? It's been a I guess, a good positive week in Reds baseball, despite the fact that the Cleveland series could have gotten a little bit better. Texas was kind of a wash, but finishing the way they did off the Astros was really, really cool. And seeing guys like Joey Votto and Yasiel Puig and Jesse Winker as well start to get hot again. Hopefully this time a week from now, we've got some more good news from the Cincinnati Reds front, because it seems like this team maybe, just maybe, might be starting to round into form a little bit.
Yeah, man. I like being in a good mood when I go into those podcasts. So
yeah, I know, right? For sure. Well, all right. Well, for Tony, I'm Wick. You can find us at Red Reporter on Twitter. You can find us at redreporter.com. You can find us on Facebook at Red Reporter Fans. And you can find Tony's work at fangraphs.com now as well. Check him out. He's got a couple good articles up already, and I look for nothing but more of those to come up throughout the course of the summer. But, yeah, tune in. Check us out. Read us. Thanks for subscribing and listening. And we will catch up with you all at some point next week.